Justice Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly. Are we not saying party affiliation? I can't remember if anybody else did. But ANC, ANC as the previous three members of the committee were obviously not the committee secretary.
Good morning. My name is Llewellyn Landers, Member of Parliament and a member of the African National Congress.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Zukiswa Kularanto from Eastern Cape. I'm a member in the National Council of Provinces, a loyal member of the African National Congress.
Morning, I'm Wendy Nelson, also from the National Assembly, deployed by the ANC.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. My name is Chata Mofokeng, a member of the committee from the ANC.
Hello, I am Nick Kornoff, a member of the National Assembly and from COPE.
I am Wes van der Merwe, National Assembly and a member of the party that will win the next general election in Qatar.
My name is Henrik Schmidt. I'm a member of the National Assembly. And may I register my apologies for having to leave within the next 10 to 15 minutes due to another disciplinary matter I need to conduct. My apology.
Morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lex Mpati, President of the Supreme Court of Appeal.
Judge Nugent, also from the Supreme Court of Appeal, and no party affiliations.
Morning, Mike. My name is Gerald Friedman. I'm a retired judge, president of the CAPE.
Morning, everyone. Craig Howey, I'm retired president of the SCA.
Chair, might I just mention and apologize for another member of our committee, Judge President Mwepe from Pretoria. He is on his way. So he will be here a bit later.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, once more, let me also welcome every one of you. Compliment of the new season. This is our first meeting in 2012. And then I just want to briefly talk about the status where we are insofar as the code for judicial conduct as well as the rules for registrable interest is concerned. I've made some few notes here. You'll recall that in relation to the code was drafted by the former Chief Justice Ngobo, and in respect of which the minister gave his concurrence, was tabled in Parliament by the Minister on the 1st November 2010 as required by the Judicial Service Commission Act of 1994 as amended. The code was published for public comment and the ad hoc committee conducted public hearings thereon. The department thereafter summarized the comments made during the public hearings, and then apart from the technical corrections were made during the hearings were also effective in the original code. And then subsequently thereafter, the ad hoc committee received an indication from the Law Society of South Africa that it wished to make some submissions on the code, and that the ad hoc committee had agreed it would accord it that opportunity. And then further, the ad hoc committee also agreed that it would also give an opportunity to any other interest group which could not have made its submission during the public hearings before the ad hoc committee deliberations on the code. Now, let me now focus on the regulations. The minister tabled in Parliament the draft regulations on the same date that he tabled the code. At the time, the regulations were tabled former Chief Justice Ngobo had not given his concurrence in relation to the draft prepared by the minister as required by the Act. And then former Chief Justice Ngobo indicated to the minister that at the time that the heads of courts had established a task team which proposed certain amendments to the Judicial Service Commission Act to allow the views of the judiciary to be accommodated in the regulations. And then in his letter of tabling addressed to the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, the Minister indicated that the judiciary intended to propose certain legislative amendments and draft the regulations and requested Parliament to await same before processing the regulations he had tabled. The ad hoc committee then deferred public hearings on the regulations until such time that Chief Justice Ngobo has given his views on the regulations. Therefore, there were no public hearings held insofar as the regulations were concerned. And then, subsequent to the tabling of the regulations by the minister, the former Chief Justice Ngobo submitted to the minister draft regulations on the judge's registrable interest, accompanied by proposed amendments to the Judicial Service Commission Act of 1994. The latter draft regulations were premised on the proposed amendments to the JSC Act drafted by the task team of the heads of courts. The minister referred the draft regulations and the proposed amendments to the Judicial Service Commission Act to the ad hoc committee for consideration by the latter. Now, the purpose of this gathering today is that the judiciary, the eminent judges, have thought it wise that they would like to make a presentation to the ad hoc committee, and then thereafter we'll take the process forward. I should just mention that the lifespan of this ad hoc committee has been extended until we are reporting back on the 24th of February. We were supposed to be reporting back on the 24th of February, and then it is in that light that we are trying to expedite the matter as far as possible. I don't know whether my chairperson would like to say something before we give the opportunity to the judiciary to make a presentation.
No, Chair, just one slight issue is that the possibility of us not reporting back on the 24th of February is there because, you know, the majority of members of the NCOP here are part of the team that is dealing with the information bill, you know? And unfortunately, for the whole of February, all members will not be in Cape Town for the whole of February, and that's the problem we are going to be faced with. But also indicated that we have to deal with, in terms of, with the program itself. We might piggyback on the program that is taken up by that particular ad hoc committee in the NCOP, particularly on the areas that we have identified, which is Gauteng, the Free State, or KwaZulu-Natal and Cape Town, you know, around public hearings. I'm just indicating that because from Monday, we are not coming back to Gauteng, all of us. And the majority of members of this particular committee from the NCOP are in that committee. Yes.
Right. I think I must also, the judiciary, also maybe indicate that before we closed in 2010, we had proposed a program in terms of which would held public hearings on the, I will just call them regulations. Unfortunately, because the advert didn't go before 2010, we had to amend the program and the like. Now, in view of what my co-chairperson has stated, we are going to be having to redraft we have redrafted the program and the like. But we are aware of the agency of the matter in view of certain matters that needs to be handled in terms of the Judicial Code of Conduct and the registrable and the rules for the registrable interest. We bear that in mind. We want to indicate to the judiciary. Thank you very much, Judge President Mbati.
Thank you, Chair. Let me first start by expressing our appreciation to the committee for affording us the opportunity to come and address you on these matters that are before you today. If I may start with the question of the code of conduct, there is nothing on the side of the judiciary that requires our attention now on that aspect. I do understand what you have just mentioned, that the Law Society had indicated a wish to make some submissions. May I just say that the question of the code is a bit urgent. If I may speak, for instance, as a member of the Judicial Conduct Committee, when we receive complaints in respect of judges' conduct, we get questions as to under what paragraph or clause of the code am I being charged, or is the complaint based? And we are unable to say, because the code it has not been approved yet. So if it were possible for the code to be put through as a matter of urgency, we would appreciate that, because I don't believe that the code is dependent on the regulations regarding registrable interests, judges' registrable interests, if that is possible. Now, secondly, you mentioned that the Chief Justice, or former Chief Justice Nabo, told you that the heads of courts have established a task team to look at the regulations. The task team consisted of my colleagues to my left, Justice Nugent, Justice Friedman, and Justice Howie. And I'm going to ask Justice Nugent to begin with our submissions. In that regard, he will be followed by Justice Friedman, and Justice Howie will come in. My colleague, Justice Mwepe, Judge President Mwepe, has just walked in, and I've apologized on your behalf. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Judge President Mwepe. We did receive some indication that you will be joining us a little bit late. Thank you very much. Right, Judge Newton.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The matters you're dealing with today, they go back to some years. And in my view, the reason for that is that there's never been proper discussion between the legislators and the judiciary on what is required, if anything. There's never been a face-to-face discussion with the department, and unfortunately one's ended up with drafts prepared by the department, which they send to us. Mm-hmm. We prepare drafts that go back to them, and there's no engagement on the issue. So I'm very pleased to be here today to attempt to engage on the issue. And at the end of what I say, I'm going to suggest to you that perhaps there should be more direct engagement before this matter goes further, to see if we can actually reach agreement, because I see no reason why the legislature and the judiciary should be at odds on the issues here. There are really three matters that are before you. The first is the code of conduct, and as Party has already said, I don't think that's controversial at all. Those principles were drawn up largely by the judiciary, but in fact they've been accepted, they've been provided the basis for the adoption in other parts of the world of of codes of ethics, and I think they're regarded generally throughout the world as a very fine document. So I'm not going to deal with that at all. If there are difficulties, well, obviously we'll deal with those, but I don't think that we need to take your time with that at the moment. There are two other issues, in fact, and not just the disclosure issue. There are two issues, and they're interrelated to some degree. A lot of what we're going to be dealing with does deal with disclosure by judges. Mm-hmm. But there is some crossover, because the Act itself also places restrictions on what judges may do, and those restrictions are then reflected to some degree in those disclosure regulations. But I'm going to deal mainly with the disclosure regulations, and I'll come back to the restrictions on judges later, and Judge Friedman is going to, I think, take that up a little further as well. Now, if I may just make one general observation, and that is that you as legislators will be well aware that when drawing up legislation, one ought to be make sure that right at the beginning one is pertinently aware of what the problem is. In other words, what is the mischief that one needs to overcome? And if one doesn't do that, one is liable to produce legislation that is not coherent, that is arbitrary, that is irrational, that has no proper justifiable basis. And that, I think, is particularly pertinent in this case, because the Act and the regulations makes major intrusions upon the privacy of judges and their families. And in order for that to survive constitutional scrutiny, one's going to have to show that there's a rational basis for that. And that is going to require that one establishes what is the mischief, why does one need laws to overcome it, and one's going to have to show that they have a legitimate purpose, and that the laws go no further than is required to meet that legitimate purpose. So I think one must be very careful here to identify what is the problem, if there is one. Now, we have never really been told what the problem is and what it is that we need to address. One has had to speculate to some degree, and we can see only two possible difficulties. Why does one need disclosure by judges? First of all, it's possible that you may consider that that is necessary so that people who appear before the judiciary can be satisfied that there's no conflict of interest. Now, I don't think that that is a major issue, and I doubt very much that that has prompted this. Judges generally, if they think there is any chance of a conflict of interest, they disclose it in court, because it's in their interest to do so. There's no downside to it for the judge. In fact, if he discloses interest, he can usually go and play golf in the afternoon if they object. So I don't think that is a major issue. The other possible issue is that there might be concern that judges are moonlighting, as it were, taking money on the side, having commercial interests on the side that are incompatible with their judicial office. Now, I've been in the law for some 35 years. It's possible that events of that kind have occurred. I know of only one. It is by no means a major issue as far as I'm concerned. I don't know of any cases where it has been alleged, except on one occasion, that judges take money on the side, are engaging in businesses of various kinds or commercial transactions that are in conflict with their duties. So I think one must see it, first of all, in that light, that there is no identified major problem that is occurring at the moment. But we recognize that it might be, in a world in which there must be transparency, that there might be a case to be made for some sort of disclosure. And it's on that basis that we have prepared our submissions to you, and I'm not going to go through them in detail. You have them. I think it is also important to bear in mind that, as often happens, I'm sure, that when you propose legislation, lots of people object. They tell you why you shouldn't do things. You get that knee-jerk reaction. You shouldn't do this. We have gone a bit further in this case. We've tried to be constructive. We have not only told you why we have difficulties with what is proposed, but we have prepared ourselves a response to that, and to say, look at this, this is how the judges see it, and this is what we propose. And I mention that because I think that indicates our desire to actually engage on this issue and get it out of the way finally. It's been hanging around for years. Now, Let me then turn to the question of disclosure. As I see that those regulations that have been produced, there is no central theme in it which indicates that the draftsman knew what problem he wanted to deal with and set about dealing with it. It's almost as if, it seems to me, this draftsman was given the instruction, judges and their families must make full disclosure of their affairs, and he then prepared the regulations accordingly, without identifying how those regulations should be drafted to overcome whatever mischief they might be thought to have been. As a result, their regulations are very simple that have been proposed. They simply say judges and their families must disclose their affairs and they'll be in a register. That's as simple as it is. But underneath that simplicity is, in our view, a simplistic view of the whole problem. Now, let me deal first of all with disclosure by family members. I'll then come to disclosure by judges, because it's really in two parts. These regulations require a judge to disclose the interests of his or her spouse and close family members. Now, that requires that all the affairs of the family member must be disclosed, and by the judge, not by the family member, by the judge. Now, you can imagine this. There are many judges today whose partners or spouses have business interests. I think, for example, of judges in our court. One of them has a husband who is a senior partner in a major firm of attorneys. Speak for myself, I have a wife who's a specialist doctor who's got her own private practice. Is it really suggested that they are supposed to disclose all the interests that they have in their professional lives, all the assets that they have, and all the income that they have? And for what purpose is that to be disclosed? Imagine the conversation, and I use this just as an example to try and illustrate the problems that you'll have. And I'm again just talking in broad terms and not on the detail. There are many problems with the detail, but that's another matter. I go home to my wife and say, you're required, I am required to tell a registrar of all your interests. I know that you have a practice. I know that you have a small trust that is in, you're engaged with the family that looks after mother and father and grandchildren, etc. I want to know the details of all of that. I want to know precisely what income you earn. And I'm going to go and make a disclosure of that. Well, what is she going to say to me? And say, why on earth should I do that? I'm not really going to be able to tell her. I'm going to say that's what the law requires. For what purpose, she'll say. I'll say, I have no idea, so I can't understand why it should be disclosed. She's then going to say, and it gets worse, she's going to say, but I've never even disclosed these, much of this to you. You and I live in a relationship in which I have autonomy in my professional life, and so do you. And so we've conducted our lives as adult people with autonomy. I must now disclose this all to you, and you must disclose it to the judge. Why do you want to know about this? Said, I'm not interested at all. We have a very happy life, getting on with our own affairs. I don't want to know about it. But you've got to tell me, because I have to tell the registrar. She will say to me, well, who's going to have access to all this information? I'm going to say, all the heads of court, and the Chief Justice, and the registrar, and anyone who the registrar chooses to give access, any official. She said, why should the heads of court all know about this? I have no idea, I said, but that's what the regulations require. What does the judge president of the Northern Province have to do with all this? I have no idea. She'll say, who are these people that the registrar is going to be entitled, without even asking me, to disclose to? Who are these officials? I say, I have no idea. That's for the registrar to decide. How many officials? She'll say. I said, I have no idea. It's for the registrar to decide. She'll say, and is there any confidentiality once all of this is disclosed to all these people? I'll say, no. There's no penalty if they disclose it to anyone else. What happens to the information is going to be out of your control. it gets worse. She'll say to me, well, can anyone else have access to this? Can my competitors, if I'm in business, can my fellow doctors know about my affairs? Well, I say, no, it's in a confidential part of the register, apart from those who I've mentioned who will have open access to it. Others must apply. And she'll say, well, who can apply? Can my competitors? Yes. Do they have to give any reasons? Is there anything in the regulations which circumscribe the basis upon which this must be disclosed? I'll say no. I've got no idea on what basis that will be done. Who will determine this? A committee of judges, I'll say. She'll say, do I have any chance to object? I'll say no. I'm entitled to object, but you're not entitled to object. You won't be able to appear before these judges and tell them why this should not be disclosed. I will have to do it on your behalf. Now, how can that be justified? If you can tell me what justification for that is, I would welcome it, because I can see no justification for that massive invasion of his or her privacy that I've just described. You see, you might offer the following explanation. One might say, look, judges are a rather dishonest bunch. They will go and do business, and they're going to put it in your name. They're going to put these things in your name, so they're going to try and cover for themselves. Well, that's rather ludicrous, isn't it? If a judge is going to do what a judge knows he's not entitled to do, the last thing he's going to do is put it in his wife's name to make these disclosures. You're going to say, well, why not deal with your brother-in-law? I don't have to make disclosure for my brother-in-law, so why not put the business into his name? Why not put it in my son's name? Why not put it in my friend's name? So the fact of the matter is, with all this disclosure, even if it is suggested that judges are going to use their wives to cover up their activities, won't achieve the result anyway. Which judge is going to put it in his wife's name when he can do it with his brother-in-law? Of course. So you have this no explanation for this huge disclosure, and if there is one that one can speculate on, it's easily overcome in any event. So these regulations, well, let me take this a step further as well. Assuming that one does disclose all this for your wife, well, how will one know what part of the things are being disclosed are actually not your wife's legitimate business, but some business of your own that has been passed off as that of your wife? Is one going to interrogate my wife about what these interests were? Is one going to interrogate her about where this income comes from? Is one going to interrogate her on where these assets come from? Of course you're not going to. So there is simply no basis upon which these regulations, so far as they apply to the family, will have any effect at all, other than to be a major invasion of their privacy. Now, one has to ask oneself then, before one proceeds with these regulations, what prospect is there of a constitutional challenge succeeding? On what I've told you, there is every prospect. They are irrational, they serve no legitimate purpose, and they go far beyond any legitimate purpose one might speculate on. Let me then turn to disclosure as far as judges are concerned. Now, judges are in a rather different position. And when I refer to judges now, I'm referring to sitting judges, retired judges, and acting judges. I will deal with them each separately, but for the moment, I'll deal with them together. Judges are required to make full disclosure of all their assets, all their income, and so forth. That doesn't go into a confidential part. That is open to the public. Anybody who has an interest, any busybody, can go and look at this register and go and see what my financial position is. A newspaper reporter who decides to do an article on who has what, which are the rich judges, which are the poor judges, can go and get this register out, do a nice tabulation and say, judgment party is not nice, it's at all, it's a very poor man. Look at Judge Friedman, what a rich man he is. And so publish this simply as a matter of curiosity for the public. There is simply no protection to the judges against anyone having access to this. Now let's look first of all at how this applies to acting judges. Because this will apply to acting judges as well, and their families. Now who are acting judges? Most often they are advocates who are asked by the judge president to come in for a few weeks, a month or whatever, to help out. These are advocates. They may not always be advocates, they might be attorneys as well, but the same thing applies. These are people who have their own practices, who are quite entitled to be on boards of directors, quite entitled to have other business interests, quite entitled to be earning income from some business or other, quite entitled to run private companies. But in order for that judge to now go and act for a month, he or she must make full disclosure of all his business. It is open for his competitors to look at. It is open for his colleagues at the bar to look at, open to other attorneys to look at. His wife's interests are disclosed with the consequences I've told you. All to go and act for a month. And for what purpose? He's entitled to have income from other sources. He's entitled to own assets. He's entitled to be a member of a board of directors. Why does he have to disclose this? What purpose does it serve? Is this to ensure that he doesn't earn inappropriate income? What prospect is there that a judge who goes to act for a few weeks is going to go and earn inappropriate income? In other words, income inappropriate to a judge. Or he's got to do his work for 2 weeks and go and do his own business. There is no purpose served in asking acting judges to disclose. One can rest assured that if this was the consequence of someone coming to act on the bench, no one will come and act on the bench. There is no way in the world that any judge is going to submit himself to this in order to go and do service to the state for a month at great cost to himself generally, or herself. Let me go to retired judges. When judges have done generally 20 years of service or reached the age of 70, they've done their work for the state. They've made their contribution. It's over. Yet those judges and their families must continue to make disclosure. One asks again, why? Any income that is earned by that judge is not going to be in conflict with judicial duties, because he has no more judicial duties. Any income earned by his family is going to be quite irrelevant. Any assets that he has are quite irrelevant. But yet full disclosure of the kind that must be made by sitting judges must also be made by those judges. Now, I think that one must be very careful in one's approach to retired judges. There seems to be an assumption that for some reason or other, judges, once they retire, should remain subject to directions by the state. That is simply not correct. When judges have done their duty, they have done their duty. There is no reason at all why the state should then have control over their lives. They are quite entitled to get on with their own lives once they have completed their duties. Judges who are retired, as you'll see in the code of conduct, must nonetheless behave in a particular way. They must behave in a way that doesn't bring the judiciary into disrepute. But there is no reason why they shouldn't engage in other matters, even earn income, provided it doesn't interfere with that. Let me take a few examples. Very often retired judges are called upon by the neighbouring states to go and act on their courts of appeal, for example. Well, they earn an income from that. Can there be any objection to that? Obviously not. Some judges might go and sit on the council of a university and get a remuneration for that. What objection is there to that? Judges very often get asked to sit as the ombudsman for the insurance industry, for example. Well, they do a very fine job and a great contribution to society. Yet one wants to regulate that and make them make disclosures of their income that they make from that. For what apparent purpose? Let me turn then to judges who are sitting. Now there might be something to be said for disclosure. As I said, throughout my career, I've known of only one occasion, and there may be others, of course, that have been concealed, but I don't doubt very much that there are many where that has occurred, and it doesn't pose a major problem. But as far as that is concerned, one asks oneself as well, why should every aspect of his or her financial affairs be available to the public at large? Is it because one or two judges have erred that 250 judges, etc., should be exposed to this? And the one or two judges who err, you can rest assured, if they're going to err again, are they going to cover themselves and make sure that they don't get caught out by these? All it's going to do is to say to those honest judges, and you are very fortunate to have a large majority of judges, if not all of them, who are judges that you, one ought to be very pleased that they're your judges. They do a very good job, they are conscientious, they know what their ethical duties are, they just don't do these things. But all of this is going to affect them. It is not going to catch the one or two judges who might do something on the side. But recognizing this, what we have suggested, we haven't shied away from this and said, well, don't do anything. You'll see that in our proposals, what we have done is adopted a more cautious approach. We have said, okay, let judges disclose their interests, but what should be available to the public is merely a broad outline of what their interests are, rather than the detail. In other words, if one has owned shares on the that are publicly quoted, disclose what shares there are. But why disclose the number of shares, the pool value, etc.? If you own immovable property, why do you have to disclose the address and what you purchased it for and what it's worth? Disclose that you own that property. So one has a broad disclosure in the public part. Let the public come and see what the nature is of the interests that judges have. Quite obviously, if they see their disclosure by a judge, which is most unlikely, that he or she owns a business of some kind, well, they might want to inquire further. But the public part of the register will not be such as to go into every detail of his or her affairs. That detail can be contained, if necessary, in a confidential part of the register. And that confidential part should be open to inspection by the Chief Justice, by the head of the court of which the judge sits. There's no reason why every judge president should have access to it. No reason why the registrar should determine what officials should have access to it. Those two persons, if they hear via the grapevine or see it alleged anywhere that a judge might be engaged in some illicit affairs, would be able to go to that register and satisfy himself that it's not taking place. Or if it is, you can take it further. Our proposals also make provision, though, for members of the public to get access to that information. But what they'll need to do is to apply to the Chief Justice, and they'll have to justify why they want it. It must be a legitimate reason for asking for it. If some legitimate reason is disclosed, well, it can be weighed up as to whether it should be disclosed or not, after allowing the judge to have his say, or her say, about whether this should occur. And if it does occur, and there is a disclosure, the person who obtains that information will be restricted to using it only for the purpose for which it was granted, for which it was applied for and granted, and for no other purpose. that person will be required to maintain confidentiality in that information. And unlike the present regulations, there will be penalties imposed on that person to ensure that he or she does maintain confidentiality and doesn't misuse the information. So that is the broad outline of our proposal on the regulations. And I ask you again to consider what's wrong with that. If there is a concern that judges might be doing things illicitly, why does that not satisfy the requirements to avoid that occurring? I can see nothing in that that should be objectionable, nothing more than ought to be required, but of course we are open to you to tell us why that is insufficient. So that basically is the form of the regulations that we proposed. We have said no family member disclosure. We have said no disclosure by acting judges. We have said no disclosure is required by retired judges, because as I've outlined, we can see absolutely no justification for disclosure in those circumstances. We say if you feel that there should be disclosure of, by sitting judges, well, we're amenable to that, but respect the privacy of that judge. Realize that you're going to be asking for disclosure from a vast majority of the judges who have nothing to hide, who behave properly, who behave honorably. Those are the judges who are going to be affected by it mainly. There might be one or two judges that misbehave. You're unlikely to catch them that way in the first place. But if you do, make sure that these regulations are sufficiently controlled that you won't, in order to catch the one, as it were, you expose all the others to full inquiry, full disclosure of everything that they own and earn. Let me turn then to the other subject, which is interlinked with that, because you'll see that in the regulations that are proposed, there is provision there for retired judges to disclose income that is earned after they retired. That links in with two provisions in the Act. It affects mainly retired judges, but has some effect on serving judges. There is one provision, I think these are in Section 11, which says that judges who are in office may not engage in other businesses and so forth. Well, it's fine. Got no difficulty with that. They oughtn't to be doing it in the first place. But that's covered by the Code of Conduct in any event. There is no necessity to write it again into the Act. It's in the Code of Conduct. Governs them in any event. There is one provision which I think just illustrates the arbitrariness of that provision. It says that judges may write books, textbooks, legal books, with the consent of the minister. Now just consider that. Is it legitimate for a judge to write a legal textbook? Well, I would say quite obviously it is. It contributes to the law. But if it is legitimate, on what basis can the minister refuse it, other than being arbitrary? And if it is not legitimate, why can the minister allow him to do it at all? So here you choose, the draftsman chooses a subject and says the minister may or may not allow you to do this. Well, it's either allowed or it's not allowed. A provision like that demonstrates, I think, that the Act is, that provision in the Act is not designed to achieve any particular purpose. It is designed simply to give the minister control of some kind over judges for an arbitrary reason. And I think that extends further when you look at it in relation to retired judges. There are provisions there that say retired judges may not hold any office, may not earn any income, may not do anything after they're retired without the consent of the minister. Now, why again does one need that? I've already said to you that there are many things that judges do that contribute to the society. Many judges, by the time they retire, still have their faculties. They can make a contribution to society, and they do. there are many things that are quite legitimate. Why should a minister's consent be required for him or her to act as the ombudsman of the insurance industry? It's a contribution he's making to the society. Nothing wrong with it. It's completely compatible with the judge's, a retired judge's position. It doesn't bring the administration of justice into disrepute. And so we can go on. The code applies as much to retired judges as to judges. And it has a very simple provision in it. It says judges, retired judges, may not do anything that is incompatible with the judicial office or that may bring the administration of justice into disrepute. If he or she does that, action can be taken against the judge. There is no reason, though, why everything has to go through the minister and the minister must approve before anything can be done. Again, in our view, what that demonstrates is only one thing, that what the draftsmen of this provision wanted to achieve was simply to exercise control over retired judges for the sake of exercising that control, for no particular legitimate purpose, to achieve nothing of any significance other than to exercise control over the judge. And I've said at the beginning that I think that one should appreciate that judges who have gone into office, spent 20 years of their lives doing this, should be entitled, once they've finished that, to enjoy the rest of their lives and to be able to achieve fulfillment in the rest of their lives after they have performed their service. So we have very strong objections to a provision of that nature. And in our proposals, we have suggested that once again, one simply repeats what is in the code in any event, which is judges who have retired must behave, essentially. They must behave as you would expect of retired judges, and it's quite sufficient. Let me just close with one little observation that I think that you might like to consider as legislators. There are some activities in which one should be very careful in legislation of tabulating particular instances of prohibition. In other words, a retired judge may not do anything that will bring the administration of justice into disrepute, and in particular A, B, C, D, and E. And let me tell you why that is something that one should always think of avoiding in cases like this. It provides loopholes. Judges then say, oh, well, this is not listed. You'll find a way between all this. And the more detail you give, the greater the prospect that the loopholes will be found. You will find in any provisions relating to professional conduct, doctors, accountants, whatever it may be, they don't have those kind of provisions. They say that you must behave professionally. And what constitutes professionally is a matter that will be looked at from time to time by your peers. You do not find loopholes in that way. Judges can't duck between the lines, as it were. They must behave professionally. Judges know what is professional. They have a code of conduct if necessary and if they need guidance. And if they're not sure, retired judges, accountants, etc., they ask their peers and they get an idea of what is ethical and what is not. A judge who has served for 20 years knows what is ethical. He doesn't need to be told. And once you tabulate these little things, what you're saying to the judge is, don't worry about what you know or don't know is ethical. See if you can find your way in between these, and if you can, that's fine. So I think it's with those overall remarks I don't have anything further to say, except, but you will find, if you look at the proposals, if you want to go into the detail, the more you look at it, the more anomalies and absurdities you will find once you try and apply that in practice. I have dealt only with the overall principle because I think it is only when one has a full, proper understanding of that overall principle that one can start drafting legislation to deal with that in its detail. I said at the beginning that what I would like to see coming out of this is not this exchange of documents, which has gone on for 2 or 3 years now at least, maybe even more. I would like to see one or two, I don't believe in big committees for this kind of thing, one, two or three people from the legislature or the executive, sitting down with two or three people from the judiciary with a clear understanding of what the objective is and preparing something that hopefully will suit us both. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Maybe, Judge Mpati, if I understood, President Mpati, if I understood you correctly, we are still going to get an input from Judge Friedman as well as Judge Howick. If necessary. If necessary. I see some members itching to ask questions. I don't know whether should we maybe take questions before we proceed. What would be the best? What is the feeling of the House?
This House says yes.
Questions before we proceed.
Now, yes.
I think that's a good idea, and then if there are things that arise that may best be dealt with by Judge Friedman, if you allow me to just respond in that way and allow him to make a note of what the question is, and then he can deal with it, if that's in order, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I've noted the hand from Honourable Jeffrey, Professor Ndabandaba. Any other hand? Okay, let's take these two hands first.
Thanks, Co-Chairperson. Look, I think Justice Nugent has said a lot, sorry, I don't know if it's possible with the TV. I mean, I'm sort of talking to Judge Nugent, but I can't see him. Sorry. I think he said a lot, and I think there's a lot of validity in what he has said. I think particularly the process points of the fact that we need to have more engagement with the judiciary. If this matter does end up in the Constitutional Court, which a lot of controversial things do, I don't think it's particularly appropriate that the Constitutional Court is going to have to rule on things that affect them directly. So I think there's a lot there, and I think we also do need to open the process up to public participation. But, just responding and to some of the points that Justice Nugent raises, I mean, I think there's a bit of an elephant in the room which you haven't acknowledged, at least directly. I understand that in Victoria and England, sex between men was illegal, but that sex between women was not. And the reason why sex between women was that Queen Victoria could not conceptualize or couldn't contemplate, couldn't understand that that was possible. I'm raising that as because I think the elephant in the room is corruption. And it may be that Justice Nugent can't conceive that is possible for judges to be corrupt. But I haven't had any briefing from the department, heard any briefing from the department or from the ministry. But to my own individual understanding, that is one of the mischiefs that this process is seeking to be addressed, corruption. Not just, I mean, Judge Nugent mentioned moonlighting and conflicts of interest, but judges being paid money for decisions. And unfortunately, it's not just our country, it's the world. People on the sort of upper echelons of society are earning more and more money. Even in our society, a middle level banker can get a bonus for a year's work, their annual bonus, which could exceed your salary. And you could argue, and I'm sure you do, that you work harder, you apply your mind more, but there's somebody else younger than you, less experienced than you, who's earning a lot more. And that's banking. It goes into other sections of the private sector particularly. So we're becoming, the income disparities seem to be getting greater, and judges are at the top. And I think the fear is basically judges being paid and getting tempted to be paid to make a particular decision. And that's why, for example, it would apply, I think there's a desire to include acting judges, because acting judges are making decisions, so they could become susceptible. And, Justice Nugent spoke about one or two bad apples, but with that very analogy of apples, you have a couple of bad apples in a pack, and the whole lot go off very quickly.
But it's not just that biological or scientific fact. It's also the issue of public perceptions, that we need a judiciary that is above reproach. So I think that is the main mischief that is attempting to be addressed. And hence, it's things like immediate family would be, look, I mean, Justice Nugent, you know, says, why spouses? Why not brothers-in-laws and sons? I'm not sure about... Yeah, anyway. But I think the issue is that you've got more access, you've got more certainty that you will get the money if it goes to your spouse than if it goes to your brother-in-law, who in the end might say, no, I'm, you know, I kept this, took this gift for you. I'm now not releasing it, and you know there's nothing you can do about it. And that is the reason why, you know, the and I think it's been since 1994, public office bearers, members of parliament, members of the executive, and I think it even goes down to councillors, have these disclosure requirements. So, as far as I can see, and Mr. Landers next to me, who was chairing the Ethics Committee at one point, would I'm sure give more detail, but the provisions seem to be similar to those that apply to MPs. Now, MPs actually do not make any financial decisions. We don't award tenders. We pass laws. We perform oversight. But there are some areas, I think, in Britain where somebody took money to ask particular questions to the executive. But you can go onto the internet. I was going to say, if as long as the internet in the SCA is working all right. But you can go onto the internet and you can click onto any of our names, and our assets will pop up. It's not our financial position, it's basically assets, which is the same as what is in the register. But really, that's the concern, I think, that is being attempted to be addressed. I know that the issue of spouses is something that members of the executive have raised. Why must their wife disclose she is a businesswoman as Justice Nugent has also said in his case, why must the wife disclose? But they have to at this point. But anyway, that's really the reason. But I do think, having said all that, and I think we do need to acknowledge that's the concern. I think the one other point I'd want to make with retired judges is that I think it is you work for 7 years and then it's basically salary for life. Is it 15 years?
20 years, well, let's put it this way. There are two.
Yeah.
Either 70 years old.
Mm. Or 20 years and 65.
Okay.
Yes, that's...
But anyway, you're not paying a pension. You don't contribute because you get this...
Tributary pension.
Yes.
We get it contributed
at the end. And I think the issue would be, you know, that if you're going to be remunerated even after retirement, I suppose the rationality would come from there. Obviously, if you were just contributing to a pension fund, and the reason for that payment is presumably to protect the judge's integrity, that you you know, then are not worried about what will happen after you've been on the bench. You don't get tempted to look for taking shortcuts. But I think that I just wanted to raise those as a general response. But having said that, I think a lot of what Justice Nugent raises, a lot of the amendments, are things that we should look at, and I think there is a lot of validity in them, so I'm not rejecting them. And I do think we need further engagement with the judges, and we do need to try and produce a product that is acceptable to everybody. But we do also need to involve the public as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Jeffrey. Professor Levanever.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I just wonder what the procedure is. Should I respond quickly to each one, or shall I wait until everyone is?
Are we to ask questions or talk, make comment like JJ?
Freedom of speech, both. But if you comment, members are encouraged, maybe try to limit them. We are not restricting. Another thing we didn't talk about, we didn't indicate how long this presentation is going to be, but normally, customary, we look at it as saying it will not go beyond 1 o'clock, and without restricting the judiciary in their presentation. Thank you. Professor Ndavandava.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a small question of clarity to Justice Nugent in respect of retired judges. Precedents have been quoted from Northern Ireland, Australia, the US, and Canada. Now, could we know what's the position in other countries like Germany and other older and more mature democracies? I think we need this so that we get a complete representative picture of what is happening. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Professor Ndavandava. Honorable Rancho.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm worried now that Honorable Van der Merwe has got that question that he has just asked, because I've got concerns that I wanted to raise. But now that you said it's open, we can ask, we can comment. I think I'm a little bit freed about that, because I've got a comment that I wanted to make that says, to me, it seemingly that the judges have small confidence in the register of Parliament, or in the register of South Africa in disclosing our interests, which I think there is the confidential part of it that is not allowed to be publicized, and I think you need to have a reasonable reason to when you apply to get that information that is in the confidential part of the register. There is also a question that I wanted to raise on the disclosure itself. Is this for the first time that the judges are going to disclose, or was it an ongoing thing? Because seemingly there is a fear that the disclosure might not go the way the judges wanted it to be. Thanks.
Let me take Honorable Van der Merwe, because he was saying we should we be as long as Honorable Jeffrey. I think we are going to be a little bit shorter than him.
No, but I thought here and there Mr. Jeffrey did speak sense. Here and there. Chairperson, I think that Nugent has laid his finger on the challenge, namely, what is the problem? Why do we want to do this? Now, JJ has said the elephant in the room is corruption. The reason why we're doing this is to fight corruption. But I think judges fall in a different category. And I'd like to know what examples are there of corruption, judges being paid, judges being sent to prison in the last 100 years in this country. Because if we look at that, we may find that the elephant is a mouse. I also think that judges fall in a different category. Judicial Service Commission look for lawyers with integrity. And they fall in a different class, for instance, than politicians, of which I'm one. And there are many examples of politicians who are involved in corruption and other people. I don't know of any conviction of a judge of anything closely to corruption. To summarize, I think Judge Nugent has put his case very well, and there is a lot to be taken from that. And I'm sure if there are further communication like we have today, we can put this in bed very soon.
Before you respond, can I just allow my co-chairperson an opportunity?
Thank you, Chair. Maybe the point raised by Member Ranto as to whether this is the first time the judges are going to disclose or what. But also you must take history into consideration here. We are all aware in terms from the apartheid time as to what politics, how politics influenced judges to make wrong decisions. That is the first point we must take into consideration. And therefore, we're all fighting for transformation into the judiciary now. That is the first thing. My experience presently is that we're dealing with very serious problems. And I'm not saying in the judges themselves, but in the magistrates. Where precisely because of transformation, there is this issue around specific magistrates, and I'm saying the white magistrates, not wanting black magistrates to become to sit over civil matters. You see? Now we're not sure what is happening in the judiciary, in the judges themselves at that particular level. I'm talking about the lower courts. And I'm also saying, as we sit in today, there are not less than 100 magistrates that has been suspended last year. We're not sure as to what is happening with the judges. What are the problems? Precisely because of corruption. And that's what we're sitting with today. Now, these are the problems that we're faced with. There's also this thing that if you take back that a lot of judges with the small salary that they earn, I know they earn a lot, but with a small salary, and I'm saying older judges, not the ones that I don't know what is happening now, as they retire, they own huge farms, they own a lot of things. You don't know where they got these things from. They can't account. And that is reality. You know, some were rewarded because of apartheid, some were, we don't know what has happened in that process. You see. I mean, if you check as to how many judges owns family trusts, they are a lot. And I'm saying even new ones. What is in those trusts? Because just being a judge has a lot of influence in society. Has a lot of influence. Just being, it's like a politician. Now also, what is this fear that the judges have? Because if one branch of the state does not want to be treated the same as all branches of the state, what is this fear? What is this fear? Because you must tell us, what is your fear? Because if I have to disclose what my wife has and all those things, why should you not? Because we're one state. What is this fear? Tell us this fear. So, you know, so that, and I agree with engagement, so that when we take a decision, there shouldn't be a difference between the different parts of the state. You see? There shouldn't be that difference. The cabinet, legislature, and the judiciary. Now, why do you want to create that difference? Now, you must tell us, why do you want to do that? You never objected when it happened to cabinet, when it happened to the legislature. Why must we object when it happens to you? Now, you must tell us, because we want to understand that fear, because you might find out. I mean, that's the judge president of Cape. There's a matter in court. There's a matter that has been dealt with in court. It came before the JSE around business interests and all those things. You know, now, there are those things. You said it's 1 April. You don't know. We know that in some instances, a lot of there are these trusts that are there that judges have. You see? And I'm saying, the issue around corruption, that is the point we're trying to deal with amongst ourselves as the state. Amongst ourselves,
I'm saying the legislature, cabinet, and everybody else. But why are judges afraid to disclose? Why are judges afraid to make sure that the immediate families disclose? Now, give us that answer. So that, you know, if we can do it, why can't you do it? Now, we are told that judges are there for life. Because they can be called on called on any time, even when they are retired, to oversee whatever matter. No. Now, if you are a judge for life, why must you be treated differently? Why must you be treated differently? Now, these are the questions these are the answers we want from yourselves, so that you tell us. But you see, the biggest issue I'm raising here is the fear you have. Because if you start to disclose, you know what you have done. We are all human. No? We are not God, all of us. We are all human beings. No? There are laws that we have done. And as a human being, a lot of things could have happened. Now, just tell us the fear and assist us to make sure that we come to an understandable situation. But the point I'm raising is, why must you be treated differently? Thank you, Chair.
Chairman, can I just ask make one point, please? All right? Chairman, I just for the record, I don't think retired politicians are required to declare any interest. Yeah, but they do have a pension, and that... obviously, but the state is also contributing to that. So there is slightly, valid in the argument in terms of retired judges. Secondly, you know, I came here to listen to the submissions of the judiciary. I don't think we should, as a committee, engage at this stage with each other. I don't want to do that. I don't think it's the appropriate forum at this stage for the committee to do that. We must listen. We must listen probably to more submissions, and then we will deliberate. I don't know whether I'm wrong. If that is not the case, I want to put my point of view with regard to the submissions so far.
I want to explain the normal practice. What happens if parties are here to come and make a presentation. As the ad hoc committee, we sort of ask questions in order to determine if there are any outstanding things that will enable us, when we deliberate, we were well informed as what we are deliberating about. And right, Mr. Jeffrey.
I think we're so much we'll deliberate amongst ourselves, but what we're doing is putting points of view, not so much for other members of the committee which may agree or disagree. The Honourable Funder Merva said he did agree with some of my points, but we're actually putting it to the judges that are here for their comments. That's the key issue.
For the purpose of clarifying any other issue which we may be stuck when we reach a point where we must deliberate. We're talking ourselves.
Yes, I would be interested in the judge's response to to the views I expressed, as I think the views that other members expressed.
Exactly.
So it's being put not to compete against the air conditioning, bring up hot air, but to basically hear what the judges think of those viewpoints.
Yes. Can I just make a short remark to say this is sort of like an engagement where we clear any possibilities of some misunderstanding and the like. You know, just let's talk about an unwillingness that there should be some constitutional challenge and the like, a good relationship. Because as we are the legislature and the judiciary is there, we are serving the common South African citizenry, the people of South Africa. And then I see this as an opportunity where, for example, the judiciary is talking to the legislature, so that we should avoid talking in terms of judgments, when maybe as the legislature we pass something and then
the response thereof is a judgment or is an order striking down what the legislature has done. Right, Judge Nepen, you're going to respond, but isn't it is open to Judge Friedman, Judge Howick, as well as President Mpati and Judge President Mwepe, if you wish to respond to any or make any contribution. Let us do that so that we can move towards closing the deliberations.
Chair, can I just suggest that Judge Nugent responds to the questions and comments, and thereafter, just before Judge Friedman makes his contribution, I'd like Judge Mwepe just to speak on acting judges. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chair, I quite agree with you. It is unseemly for the legislature and the judiciary to be at odds. We are all in the same enterprise. We are all branches of government. It is our duty to provide leadership in government and not to squabble in public amongst ourselves. You may rest assured we're all on the same page as far as that concerns. For me, this meeting has been very useful. It has been useful because Mr. Jeffrey has identified what the problem is, and once one knows what the problem is, one can get on with it. We can get rid of all the other things. And the problem is one of corruption. Fine. Once we know that, one can deal with it. But let me just cast off a few other things that have been said. Now, as far as magistrates are concerned, this doesn't apply to magistrates. It applies to judges. Whatever the position is in the magistracy is not before us at the moment. There's the other point that has been raised, Mr. Jeffrey raised, it's also been raised, and I think it's quite the wrong way to approach it, and that is to say, listen, we as parliamentaries have to do it, you should do it as well. There are good reasons, no doubt, why parliamentarians have to disclose. I don't know what their disclosure requirements are or what the reasons are fully. That's another matter. But one cannot take two completely different groups and say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I think that one goes on the wrong track there. You've got to identify what the problem is, if there is one, with the judiciary and Parliament and the executive, and deal with them according to what the problem is. Mr. van der Merwe has raised a very important point. Judges are appointed after having been interrogated by a judicial service commission that hopefully establishes that they are fit and proper to be judges. Now, that doesn't always work, but they have been through that process, and they ought to, by the time they get appointed, they ought to, in fact, be fit and proper persons, and to have found to be so by the Judicial Service Commission. Now, Mr. Jeffrey also says, and he said, Judge Nugent can't believe it's possible that judges might be corrupt. Well, you're quite wrong. I said that in my experience, I have no knowledge of ever coming across a corrupt judge in this country. That it is possible, you may rest assured, I've seen enough of life to know that it is possible. And anything is possible. So I don't reject that. So let's concentrate then on what the real problem is, corruption. We all want to fight corruption. The judiciary, I assure you, is well behind you to fight corruption. And if there is any corruption in the judiciary, we will be the first to say it must be rooted out. There are many in the judiciary already who say there have been allegations of misconduct, etc. They ought to be rooted out and disposed of once and for all and quickly so that the barrel does not get rotten. But I don't think as well that one should assume that if there is a rotten apple in the barrel, that it will transmit to all the other judges. Most of your judges, by far the majority, and I don't know, I couldn't identify for you any that don't fit into this category, are people of integrity who do their job, and they do it, it's not a job for them, it is a calling. That's how most of them go about the job. But I look forward, now that Mr. Jeffrey has identified that, I look forward to engagement with you. What does one do to avoid corruption occurring, number one, and to avoid a public perception that there might be corruption. Once we have got that in place, then I think that one can forget about many of the things I've dealt with. We can exclude those because they don't help. So we would be on the right track once we engage on what that problem is. As far as the position in other countries is concerned, I'm not fully aware of what the position is. But I'm not aware of any other countries. It might happen in America, I think. But I'm not aware of any other countries where this is required disclosure by judges. And let me also get rid of one misconception, and that is about, well, judges get a salary for life and therefore they should be accountable. You know, the salary for life business comes from way back. I don't know fully what the reason for it, but part of it I know, where the government said, look, instead of contributing money to a fund over 30 years and leaving this money then tied up, you will not have a pension fund and you will get paid from current income as time goes on. So it was a very practical reason for, for good reason. Now, you might think it's very, very good for a judge, very nice for judges, very luxurious to have a salary for life. But you know, there's a trade-off that had to take place. When I became a judge, I assure you, my income at that stage was about what I'm getting now 18 years later, allowing for inflation over 18 years. One had to take a big knock in those early days. One could not, there was simply not the money. I could not have provided for myself and for my family for their future. What one did have is say, well, I will give up present because at least I know that I'll be catered for in older age properly and that I don't have to find the money for doing that. So I think it's a bit simplistic, if I may say so, to say, well, you're getting this wonderful salary, it shouldn't be so, and now you should pay for it in some way. It's a little bit more complex than that, and I think you should have a little bit of consideration for what the judges give up in order to get that. Bear in mind as well, if I left the judiciary one day before I've served 20 years, I walk out with nothing. There is no accumulated pension, as other people might have. There is nothing. I must remain there for 20 years and not a day short in order to get anything for my retirement. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Judge Nepent. Judge Friedman. I'm sorry, Judge Friedman. Can we allow Judge President Mwepe an opportunity?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I must speak about the position of acting judges with regard to the impact these regulations as they stand may have on the whole process of appointing acting judges. I will take as an example my division, and the point I want to make is that we will not be able to have people appointed as acting judges if these regulations stand as they are. We are going to hamper the administration of justice. I'll speak in relation, as an example, in relation to my own court. At any given time, we have a minimum of, and I'm including Pretoria and Johannesburg, a minimum of 20 to 22 acting positions which we have to fill. We have about 72, 74 judges, permanent judges, but over and above that, we still need, on average, 22 acting positions to fill. Now, practitioners do not come for all the term. Their term is about 9 to 10 weeks. In each term, we have got that number of acting positions. And I'm not talking the number of acting judges, I'm talking the number of acting posts. On average, each such acting post will be filled by three people. They will come for 3 weeks, can only come for 3 weeks, go back to their practice, another one takes over for another 3 weeks and so forth. In other words, at the end of a 9-week period, you would have 66 acting judges. 66 people who would have come in and left over the 9 to 10 week period. Now, to say that every one of those 66 people must, every time when they come to act at my court, must complete, go through this process of disclosure and the like, is going to cause problems. Firstly, we don't appoint acting judges to as a favor to them. They get appointed as a favor to us. We need them, they don't need us. I need them in order to run those courts. As it has happened in many instances, some of them just decline, even under the best of circumstances. Now, when you are going on top of that, you are going to require of each one of them to make a disclosure of this nature, of their interest, their families and the like. How long are you going to get? Who will be willing to go through that process in order to come and do you a favor? Let me tell you that on average, to get one person to agree to come and act, I phone is 1 out of 4. Now, if I get 66 people to come and act, it means I shall have contacted 66 multiplied by 4. Sometimes, to fill those posts, I speak to about 200 advocates and attorneys. On average, it's a full-time job for my office, a section of my office, to recruit acting judges. Many times, 3 out of 4 will not be available. But I have no way of knowing in advance who is going to be available. So I must sit on the phone and find out who is going to be available. And as I say, this is difficult under the best of circumstances. And I foresee that if you're going to apply these regulations, we are going to find it even more difficult to get people to come and act, especially in big divisions such as mine. It is not an overstatement to say we are going to end up with no or insufficient acting judges because of these regulations. So I plead that proper thought has been given, but more thought should be given to these difficulties before you enforce this kind of impediment on us, especially in big divisions. And I think, let me stop there. I was tempted to speak on other difficulties, but let me restrict myself just to the issue of acting judges.
Thank you, Judge President Mwepe. Judge Friedman.
Thank you, Chairperson, for giving us this opportunity of addressing you on behalf of the retired judges. In preparing for this meeting and in preparing our memoranda, Judge Howie and I had occasion to be in contact with as many retired judges as we were able to contact, and I think therefore when I speak today, I speak on behalf of the retired judges generally. I don't think that there are any who would disagree with what I say. The first point I want to make as a retired judge is this: that what has emerged from this meeting this morning quite clearly is that the necessity for these regulations of disclosure of registrable interests is an endeavour to combat possible corruption. There cannot be any other reason. And as a retired judge, I ask the question, what possible reason can there be for wanting me? I've been retired now for 13 years, to make a disclosure of my interests when I can't possibly corrupt anybody. If I was corrupted when I was a sitting judge, that is history. And the disclosure of my registrable interests at this stage is going to take that matter no further. Having said that, I must say I'm not aware of retired judges being involved in any activity that could be regarded as corrupt or any activity in respect of which they can be considered as having been corrupted. Every retired judge recognizes that as a retired judge he or she has a responsibility not to involve him or herself in any activity, remunerative or otherwise, which could be construed as bringing the judiciary or the administration of justice into disrepute. The code of conduct as presently drafted stipulates that obligation on a retired judge, and in the memorandum which we placed before you in paragraph 1 we suggested that sections 11(2) and section 3 insofar as they were applicable to retired judges should be deleted from the legislation and a section inserted in the law which specifies that a judge who has been discharged from active service may not hold any office of profit or engage in any business or other activity which could bring the judiciary or the administration of justice into disrepute. Now, if there is in the law such a provision, I ask the question, why must I as a retired judge disclose my financial interests to anybody? The deputy chairperson said, well, judges get a salary, therefore what is the fear that we have? May I say, there is no question of fear here. It's not a question of fear. It is a question of what is the justification for it. We're not frightened of anything. But we ask the question, you want to legislate for us to disclose our financial interests? I ask why. Once there is in the code of conduct, and if there were a provision enforcing that in the law, which says that a judge may not do certain things when he's retired or she is retired, what is the necessity for the disclosure of assets when a retired judge is not in a position to exercise any act which is going to lead to corruption? They don't make decisions. A retired judge can be asked to serve on the bench for periods of 3 months in the year until he reaches the age of 75. Maybe for that 3 month period he should be asked to give a list of his assets, although I cannot for the life of me see what the reason for such a provision could be. But most of us have passed that stage. We can't be asked anymore. I've long passed it. 8 years ago I passed that obligation. And consequently, if one really comes to analyze this whole thing, there is absolutely no necessity, if one is combating corruption, to ask retired judges to give a list of their assets. And the fact that members of parliament are asked to do it doesn't provide a reason. There's absolutely no reason at all. I'd like to just touch on a couple of activities that the judges who've retired have been engaging in over the years. Both prior to the advent of democracy in this country and subsequently, retired judges have been asked to sit in neighbouring territories on the courts of appeal. retired judges have acted as ombudsmen. They've been appointed as commissioners under the Companies Act to investigate a particular liquidation. They've been asked to sit as the chairperson of the Financial Services Appeal Board, among others. They've also been asked to do arbitrations. In all these activities, I cannot conceive of a possible instance of a judge in any of these capacities has done anything that could be regarded as a smudge on the good name of the administration of justice in this country or of the judiciary of this country. So it's not a question of us having to say that we fear that we would, if we had to disclose our assets, and why should we fear? That's not the test at all. The test is, what are these regulations aiming at? They're aiming at corruption, as Mr. Jeffrey very correctly pointed out. And accordingly, there is no basis for applying these provisions to acting judges. Not only to acting judges, but I'm talking about retired judges. Acting judges are an indication of an entirely different problem. And having made these general remarks about these regulations, may I just deal briefly with a couple of aspects. I associate myself entirely with what Judge Nugent said about family members. I, as a retired judge of 13 years standing, and having spent far more than 35 years in the legal situation in this country, I had no fear of making any disclosure, of making a disclosure, or of asking my wife to do so. But why should she? Why should a family member, after all these years, be asked to give a list of his or her assets? When one thinks of it, it's so ludicrous that there cannot possibly be a reason for it. Why should the heads of court have access to a register of retired judges' interests when a retired judge is not even a member of that court? He's not a member of any court. So why have the heads of court got a right to look at the assets of a retired judge, his wife, and family members? And what business is it of the registrar or a person designated by him to have access to these assets, to these registrable assets? The whole problem arises from the fact that, unfortunately, there is a law which says at the moment, section 11(2), which applies to retired judges, and section 13, which requires retired judges to disclose their assets in a registry. That's why these regulations exist. The minister had no alternative but to introduce them. And that is why we say in our memorandum, you can't really draw a distinction between the regulations and the law under which they are made. And following on Judge Nugent's suggestion that we should discuss this matter further on an amicable basis, we say that the relevant provisions of the law which necessitate this kind of regulation should be amended. It's as simple as that. And we maintain that there shouldn't be a confrontation between the judiciary and the retired judiciary and the legislature on this question. Let us get together and let us thrash it out and see what has to be done in order to avoid the necessity of having regulations of this kind insofar as they apply to retired judges. You know, we, in our memorandum, we've said that we regard the legislature, the legislation, insofar as it applies to us, as being unconstitutional. We drew the attention of the previous Chief Justice to this problem, and we asked for an opportunity through him to have the advantage of a discussion with the Minister about it. But up to now, we haven't had such an opportunity. And I just want to say categorically that the last thing that we want to have is a confrontation between the judiciary and the legislature. And therefore, we ask, Chairperson, we ask you to have regard, when you deliberate, to have regard to what we've said in our memorandum, and particularly to draw the attention of the Minister to what we suggested should be done to remedy this possible conflict. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm told there is tea outside. Would we want to have a short break, or alternatively maybe allow President Howick to say something? What is the feeling of the House?
I move that we drink tea.
Maybe let me ask from President Howick, would you like to make a comment now, or would you like to do it after people drink for the tea?
I won't be long, Chair. No. Thank you for the opportunity. I align myself with what's been said. We are not concerned here with the fear of disclosure. The problem must be looked at the other way. It's a question of justifying the intrusions. And as regards family and particularly spouses, just as you in a contract can't require somebody to get someone else's agreement, you can't, in a statute, require a person to get someone else's agreement. I can undertake to do from my side what I can to get my wife to give me details, but I cannot secure an agreement. And even if you thought that the information required was relevant, and the answers have already been provided why it isn't, the legislation seeks to, or the regulations seek to achieve what is not in law competent. Other than that, I would endorse from the retiree's point of view that the question of the salary is something that simply doesn't explain why the information is sought. There's no connection, there's a disconnect. Because what you're not looking for is how I spend my salary. What you're looking for is the possibility that I've acquired assets by illicit means from somewhere else. Well, the salary's got nothing to do with that. If you were looking for somebody who, in the last years of his service, behaved in a way that all this legislation is seeking to combat, what happens after his retirement is not going to bear on the problem at all. What you're looking for is evidence of what happened at the time before he retired. And these figures are not going to mean a row of beans. One way of approaching the corruption problem, and this is not really the retiree's position at all, but the serving judge's position, And one would think that the most obvious sign that something has gone wrong is when a decision is totally against the evidence. Usually that's dealt with by an appeal, but it would be evidence for within the court concerned that the person, that the judge concerned, should perhaps have an eye cast over what he or she has been doing. But that would lead to a train of investigation. But until that sort of thing happens, the financial inquiry is really not going to take you anywhere. One accepts that when it comes to serving judges, the position may well be compatible with other arms of government, and that a registrar is required. But as has been pointed out, it's a register that has to be administered with a great deal of discretion and care. But let me not stray onto that. That's been dealt with already. As far as the retired judge's position is concerned, I have nothing further to say.
Thank you very much. We are very democratic. We'd like to hear from the House how much time does the House need for break. 5 minutes? Are we agreed? 10 minutes. Let us break for tea for 10 minutes and we'll resume thereafter.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much and welcome back after the tea break. And then before I try to establish whether there are any other people who want to make some comments, there is one issue I didn't hear any person talking about it, and that one is the fact that if a judge passes away, am I correct to say that the spouse then continues to get a pension or a salary of a judge? Is it not the reason why you've got to disclose the interest of your spouse?
Can I just answer that to
The spouse gets a portion, but certainly not the whole salary, but a portion carries on for the spouse.
Thank you, Judge Nathan. Are there any questions? I note Honorable Jeffrey and then Honorable Landers. Is that all? Yes, please. Honorable Jeffrey.
No, it was just after listening to Judge Wepe and Judge Nugent on the acting judges, I mean, I see the problem. And I was going to ask them both, that's the problem, but how does one then ensure that there is a mechanism for if this register applies to other judges, because one wants to check that they don't have the opportunity to make particular rulings in a particular way, what proposals could you make to try and address that problem with acting judges? But then Judge Howie, I made a suggestion with regard to retired judges, which I think may take care of the problem. And I would be interested, not necessarily now, but maybe at a later point, if the judges could come back to us. And that is maybe that with regard to the acting judges, that they don't have to disclose, but that there is a provision requiring them to disclose in the event of a complaint having been raised about a decision that they reached. You know, either to I don't know who, maybe to the relevant JP or the Chief Justice, but that may be the solution. So I don't know what your comments on that would be. As I said, if not necessarily now, but to come back to us, that you know, acting judges then don't have to disclose as a matter of course, but there is a provision requiring them to disclose if requested or if asked to do so on the basis of a complaint around a judgment or their conduct during a particular case. So it's complaint linked rather than general course. Maybe that could be a solution to that problem.
Thank you, Honourable Jeffrey. Honourable Landers.
Chairperson, at some stage in my membership of this institution called Parliament, I was made to chair what is called the Ethics Committee of Parliament. I sometimes say for my sins.
So you say made to chair.
And so I have some experience of how things are done here. It is true, as Judge Nugent points out, Chair, and this applies to us as well, that you can't force spouses or life partners to declare their assets. Let me give you a particular instance. Members of Parliament are required to submit their declaration forms on a particular day or by a particular deadline. And in this case, this member went to the office of the registrar to hand his in, and she inspected it and said, "But your spouse's details are not here." And this particular member said, "Well, my spouse told me to take a hike." Of course, the spouse used much stronger language. And she said to him, "You are the MP, I am not, and therefore I refuse to do so," which created a crisis, Chair, because up until then, Parliament's code said spouses must. And I think the intention was that the MP was supposed to twist the spouse's arm. In this case, the spouse resisted, and the relevant MP retreated with some dignity. The upshot of it is that we had to then amend the code in Parliament, and it now says where possible. Now, under the circumstances, Chairperson, I think we must concede that here too, in the case of judges, we are not going to be able to twist the arms of the life partners or spouses. It's going to be impossible. I just thought I should make that particular point and acknowledge that what Judge Nugent has put before us, we have to concede to. One further point which I thought I should raise, flowing from Judge Friedman's comments, and again I'm going to use a hypothetical example, if I may. The question that is before us, in the same way that Mr. Jeffrey raises the issue of the elephant in the room, the question is, has the judge, prior to his retirement, made a ruling or a judgment that benefits a particular person or company, which person or company later, during the judge's retirement, rewards that judge? the reward being in the form of shares, stocks, property. I simply put it to you that heaven forbid, I don't believe this happens, but somebody raised this as a hypothetical example of where possibly a retired judge could justifiably be asked to constantly declare his or her assets. So the harm is not done during the retirement, but rather during the tenure as a judge, and then the reward is made at a later stage. I simply put it to you for you to think about. Has this happened? I sincerely hope not. I believe it hasn't. but I think that what the regulations seek to prevent is that kind of thing happening. Now, the other point which Co-Chair and I discussed during the tea break is whether the intention of the regulations is to deal with retired judges such as Justice Friedman and others, or whether it is intended to deal with those who will retire as of now when these are approved. That is something else, Chairperson, that we need to think about as well. And then Justice Nugent or one of the other judges also raised the possibility of a smaller group of members of this ad hoc committee and a smaller group from the judiciary getting together and ironing out all the wrinkles that we have before us, Chairperson, and that is something that we would need to also think about. Those are just some of the comments I thought I should make. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lennon. I forgot to say we intend to draw it to the close, in a sense that after I take comments or questions from this side, that will be the end before the judiciary response. And then after the judiciary response, then we will put an end to the process. There was Honorable Van der Merwe. I'll come back to you, Honorable Jeffrey.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think my colleague, Mr. Landers, has just now thrown a big light on our struggle, and that is you cannot force. A judge cannot force his wife or his family. I think that is a new direction that we're taking. But I just wanted to ask one question. I agree with JJ that the problem is corruption. But all I want to know is if the secretary to the committee or somebody cannot, the department cannot look in the South African criminal history. How many judges have ever been convicted of corruption in the last 100 years?
Honorable Jeffrey.
Process issue, seeing you were saying this was it, but maybe just one, and it is a process issue, Mr. Van der Merwe's point. Look, I think that, I mean, as Mr. Van der Merwe knows, I think the answer is probably zero. But the issue is that we're all aware, I mean, those of us that are members of the Justice Committee in either House or the equivalent in the NCOP, maybe I should say those of us who are members and attend the meetings of the Justice Committee, that there are a number of cases involving the lower courts involving magistrates. Now, as has been said, this only deals with judges, but it's possible. But I think that the what would be useful, I mean, from a process point of view, and I think we need to be doing it as Parliament, is what are international comparisons? There have been problems, I think, in other jurisdictions. One doesn't want to start naming countries, both in the developed and the developing world. So it would be useful getting some kind of international comparisons in terms of the problem and more particularly the solutions. I think the judge's submission
make some reference to a forthcoming American amendment, so it would be useful to look at that. So I do think we need that information. But just really on process, if I can raise it. Judge President and Party had asked about the code, you know, that was urgent. I mean, it distinguished between the code and the regulations and asking for that as soon as possible. And nothing has really been said on the code. But I do feel, I don't know if the public have had an opportunity to make an input. If they haven't, I think they need to be given an opportunity, even if it is written. Although I take it if anyone tries to take the code to the adoption of the code to court on a process point that there wasn't public consultation, that we'd probably win then. But anyway, I think it would be useful if we can, as far as possible, see if we can accede to the Judge President's request. But I do think we do need to have an opportunity for public input if there hasn't been. It doesn't have to be hearings, but at least written. And then one can see on the basis of those written submissions whether one wants to invite people to come and make oral. And then I do think there needs to be definitely on the regulations more engagement with the public, because it's a public topical issue. One of the reasons for the regulations is not just combating corruption, but it's combating perceptions of corruption and perceptions of wrong conduct on the part of the judiciary. So I think we do need to actively get the public involved. And then I'm not against the idea of a smaller group. I mean, that's something that I think the committee can look at, the co-chairs. And then I think we all know that joint committees, well, ad hoc committees generally battle to meet. Joint ad hoc committees are even worse in terms of finding time. So I.
Thank you, Honourable. Jeffrey, my question person would like also to make some comment.
Yeah, No, Chair, I fully agree with what members have indicated. But you see, what must also bring to light that these processes in the provinces are led by retired judges. And I'm from Gauteng. I was in the legislature. A retired judge is the commissioner in charge of this particular process in Gauteng, and I know in other provinces the same is happening. Yes. I think we agree. I think the one slight problem we have in terms of process is that we are aware that we were approached by Black Lawyers Association and other legal teams around the code itself, because they feel they have not made inputs in as far as that is concerned. I therefore think it is important, maybe if we can schedule maybe one public hearing here in Cape Town and deal with that particular aspect. We can deal with the regulations later. But both of them, if we can take what is happening to the information bill, we can by the end of March have gone through both, because we must report by the 24th of February. Yes. That is the challenge we have around and in terms of the code, there's not much. I mean, people agree in terms of the code. We don't have a lot of other issues, but we must look at this whole process, Coach, around making sure that we were able to can report back, have concluded this business by the 24th of February. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I now give the opportunity for the judiciary to give its rounding or closing argument.
I'll ask Judge Nugent to say something in closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to leave you with two thoughts to consider. Mr. Jeffrey's quite right to say there's a question of perception and one must deal with it. But I want to leave you with this thought about corruption.
Can you pull you at the microphone?
Sorry. Leave this thought about corruption in your judiciary. Mr. Panamera, the answer to your question is no. No judge has ever been, I don't think, even charged with corruption.
Corruption is actually quite difficult in the judiciary. And the reason for it is this. No final decision can be made by a judge by himself. A judge who sits as first instance, you'll have to corrupt him first of all. It can go on appeal to three judges. You'll have to corrupt at least two of them, because you need two to get a majority. It can go on to our court, five judges. You'll have to corrupt another three. So in order to get to the end of the road, you're going to pay a lot of money, and you've got to get a whole lot of guys along the road. So, there is an inherent protection against corruption in the judiciary. I don't take that as saying it can't happen. I'm just saying that it is very difficult to bribe a judge successfully. Magistrates are in a different position, and we're not going to discuss, but I can tell you why they're in a different position. They don't have quite the same restrictions on how they go about their business. But with judges, it's actually difficult. The second thought I'd like to leave you with this is, as I indicated at the beginning, we didn't just put up objections to what you've done. We actually prepared something ourselves. I would urge you to look at those, and look at them very carefully. And what we really need from you as well is, what's wrong with those? In what sense are those deficient? What does it not cover? They have been given considerable thought, and we would urge you to consider those very carefully as well. And I think the last thing is to say that, speaking for myself and I'm sure for my colleagues, it has been a pleasure to be at this committee today. I felt it's been very constructive. The atmosphere here has been, may I say, not quite what I expected of parliamentarians. I thought they'd be more hostile to the judiciary, and happy to see that they have a chance to ask us questions for a change. But we really have, I found it very constructive, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank all the members for the courtesy with which we've been received today.
Chairperson, I want to make a 30 seconds remark about corruption. There was a case in England where a client came to his advocate and said, "Shall I send a case of whiskey to the judge?" And he said, "No, you want us to lose." So they won the case. And then they asked the client, "What happened?" He says, "I did send the whiskey, but in the name of our opponent."
Thank you. On that light note, Honorable Van der Merwe is known of some highlights.
We do that.
Yes. Let me take this opportunity and thank everybody for this gathering. Oh, Judge Friedman, your microphone.
I must admit that I hadn't thought of the possibility raised by Mr. Landers that a judge may, during his term of office, have been offered a bribe to give a particular judgment, but only to be paid after retirement. Well, I can't concede that that's a possibility. I hadn't thought of it. But it is such a remote possibility that in my respectful submission, it doesn't justify an all-embracing regulation dealing with all retired judges forevermore. It may be Mr. Landers' suggestion may require, in the event of a complaint about a retired judge having done something during his term of office, that it may be necessary then, under those circumstances, to compel him to make disclosure of his assets. And what inferences can be drawn from that is another matter. To have an overall provision such as we have at the moment dealing with retired judges because of the possibility raised by Mr. Landers, I think is unnecessary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Lastly, Honourable Jeffrey.
Response, but also more of a question to the judges, to what Judge Friedman had raised. The issue then may be to make it complaint linked, or the other approach would be to specify a period of years after retirement from active service. So I don't know whether that aspect is something that particularly the retired judges could look at, whether you should still have to disclose for a year or two or five after you have retired, because I would have thought that you may find some judges in a position of vulnerability as they near retirement. They then get worried, how are they going to survive, and something tempting comes along and they get tempted, but make the requirement of, don't pay me now, pay me next year I've retired, give me the stocks or the benefit or whatever. But it was just really through you, Chair, not again to respond now, but if particularly the retired judges, as they're organized, could look at that possibility of acceding to having to disclose for a few years after active retirement.
Of course, what might happen is the prior board says it will be in 10 years' time. And by that time, I might not have to pay.
I think it's called throwing the javelin, and it applies to the public service or the concerns related to the public service of do you, when you're still in a government position, take some interests, throw the javelin with the intention of going and picking it up later after you're out. So it obviously, I'm sure, you know, Judge Friedman, that if you were offered a bribe when you were in active service, that you would not be waiting. There wasn't an undertaking that it would still be paid. I mean, the issue would be a short period of time. So I don't think it's the 10-year thing would be feasible. I mean, I would have thought a year, 2 years, maximum maybe five. Yeah.
Sorry. Can I? I will leave up to my assertion that we are democratic, and I see there's some interest. Professor Ndabandaba, and then Judge President Ngwepa will come back to you now.
Chair, I just want to speak on a lighter note, confirming what Jeffrey say, which I would like to say, it is what Shakespeare calls human hamartia.
Judge President Ngwepa,
I just thought that I should respond to what Mr. Jeffrey said in relation to the problem around acting judges, that whatever issues may arise may be dealt through the process of a complaint mechanism. A few years ago, a problem arose as to how to deal with complaints against acting judges while they were acting. They have ceased to be judges because they were acting by definition and gone back into the profession. And a situation, specific situations arose in my division where there were complaints against them. And then there was a fear at one time that they might fall through the cracks because it could have been contended that they are no longer judges, and therefore the JSC could not have jurisdiction to discipline them. But that difficulty has since been resolved, because largely as a result of my instigation, as a result of those specific incidents, we have secured an agreement with the professions that once that person is no longer acting, is going back into the profession as an advocate or an attorney, the profession then takes disciplinary actions against that person, which may lead to that person's name being removed, among others, being removed from the role as an advocate or attorney. So there is a definite viable mechanism, complaint mechanism, through which people who were acting judges can still be made accountable for whatever misdemeanors.
Thank you. Allow me to close, please, now. Yeah, I was on the verge of saying I would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone, both the judiciary as well as the honorable members of parliament and officials from the Department of Justice. What has been happening here today, the judiciary was talking to the legislature, and then I think it's a way of trying to remove any misunderstandings and the like. You know, I think the judiciary has had an opportunity
of seeing what type of a creature is a politician, what type of a creature is a legislature, because normally the judiciary only interprets the law to say what was the intention of the legislature and the like. But you know, this dialogue provides an opportunity of talking and understanding one another and avoiding any other possible Judge Nipen was talking about to be at odds or conflict and the like. I had an opportunity in 2009 at the end of attending a memorial lecture at the University of Stellenbosch addressed by former Chief Justice Ngcobo, who was talking about the separation of powers, but the crux of his speech was saying from since when did the legislature starting talking, the judiciary starting talking to the legislature? Now he was analyzing all those cases where the judiciary was making decisions and the legislature was responding, etc., etc. But here we are in agreement to say there is a need to have this dialogue and the door to be remaining open, suggestion of a smaller committee, either the both chairperson trying to address any areas of misunderstanding and the like. But I want to emphasize the fact that these issues, the code and the regulations, is as urgent as ever. I serve in the JSC, Judicial Service Commission, and when the time came for talking about that, the understanding was that we are almost at the end of this process, you see, because this ad hoc committee was established in 2009. Ad hoc, by its nature, it's something of a temporal. We are now sitting in 2012, we are still an ad hoc committee. I think we must, all of us, draw to an end. Its agent, yes, Kantenplar. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll see in what way do we provide that sort of open door and how we take it forward with the speed of a Concord, I must say. My co-chairperson would like also to close.
No. You have closed. I just wanted to indicate that in terms of we have the two chairpersons in this other committee from both houses on justice. You know, we have Honorable Landers and we have Honorable Mofokeng from the NCOP. They are both chairpersons of the justice committees, and that's where this link can be made.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.